Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Christopher Leonard first visited Waldron, Arkansas in 2004 when he was covering national agribusiness for the Associated Press. Waldron looks like many rural towns that were once pillars of the American economy. Breakfast joint, local bank, and a weekly livestock auction populated by ranchers in cowboy hats. But Waldron's small-town economy is just window dressing. He writes that it would cease to exist if not for its true reason for being, Tyson Foods, the nation's biggest meat company. Tyson made a whopping $28 billion between 2010 and 2011, with $780 million in profits that year. Christopher Leonard's new book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, profiles the rise of Tyson and other mega food companies that have quietly gained unprecedented control of America's meat market and reshaped the nation's rural economies. Christopher Leonard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Now, you write about America's meat business being an outright oligarchy in our nation's heartland. And your book's title, A Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. How did this business evolve under the radar?
Well, I think one key reason it evolved under the radar is that companies like Tyson Foods, which, as you mentioned, is sort of the main firm I profile in this book, but also other big companies like Cargill, Smithfield Foods, these companies are really anchored out in rural America in small towns that the national press just never visits, and in these communities that are really far away from the view of most consumers. That's where these firms really operate. And to understand Tyson Foods, it really helped to get out to these small towns where it's really the dominant economic force, as you just described. And that's where my inquiry into this company began, sort of looking at Tyson from the bottom up, if you will, in the small towns where it really operates the economy.
Well, people who do get out, granted you are a reporter, went to Waldron, but people didn't want to talk to you. What's at stake for them?
Well, their livelihoods are at stake, and that's exactly right. This was difficult to report because truly there is an atmosphere of fear and intimidation when you've got an economy that's so consolidated as it is in these small towns where Tyson operates. When I went down initially in 2004, I mean, people were afraid to talk to me about Tyson Foods in the safety of their own living rooms. And I spent a lot of time interviewing chicken farmers. And farmer is actually kind of a bad word to describe these people. They're more like industrial meat factory owners. They're people who would borrow maybe $2 million to build a large complex of industrial chicken houses and then sign a contract with Tyson Foods, which would deliver the birds to them to raise. And these farmers were so under the control of Tyson that they were afraid their neighbors would find out if they spoke to a reporter. I mean, the control this company had was shocking to me, and that's really what led me to start reporting on this book, was just the severe power structure I saw in Waldron and other towns. It really almost felt like a feudal system.
That's the way it reads, almost indebted servitude on the part of the farmers. We have the example of Yanita and Jerry Yandell, if I'm saying that properly, who lived steady middle-class lives with their three boys until batch after batch of chickens that they got from Tyson died. Now, what happened to these farmers?
Well, this is really where the book started for me. Tyson Foods has integrated every aspect of chicken production. In other words, on the north end of Waldron, Arkansas, just as in every other big poultry town, there's a giant industrial complex that Tyson owns, which has a slaughterhouse. There's a feed mill in complexes like this, a hatchery where the birds come from, a shipping, a trucking line, a railroad spur that brings in feed. And the farmers, like Jerry and Kenita Yandell, are sort of at the mercy of the quality of chicks that Tyson Foods will deliver to their farm to raise. And what really struck me about Jerry and Kenita Yandell was the fact that they had built a poultry farming business over decades. I mean, they'd been working in this business since they were teenagers. They'd borrowed money. They worked 7 days a week. And over about 30 years, they had built a solid middle-class living in Waldron, Arkansas. They lived in a brick house and owned a couple trucks, which was a sign of affluence in that community at the time. in just a matter of a few months, they were driven out of business. They were wiped out because there was some sort of problem at the hatchery that Tyson Foods operated. It wasn't Jerry and Kenita Yandell's operation. It was Tyson's. Tyson was delivering batches of birds to their farms, and the birds were just dying out en masse. I actually went down to that farm at this time, and Jerry and Kenita, or rather at that time, Jerry was out of town, and Kenita was telling me how she would just walk through the barns and pick up thousands and thousands of birds that were dying. And Tyson never fully explained to the Yandells what the problem was with these animals, but in the end it really didn't matter. They had to pay a huge mortgage payment on their farm. And because they lost so many birds, they couldn't make that payment on their mortgage, and they had to declare bankruptcy. They lost everything literally in a matter of months through no fault of their own.
And one of their neighbors also had trouble with his chickens. He wanted to get them tested, but he couldn't because the chickens didn't belong to him. They actually belonged to Tyson.
Yes, it was remarkable, and I think it really highlights the nature of the power relationship here. One of their neighbors, Doug Elmore, was really concerned because Tyson Foods was also delivering diseased animals to his farm, and he wanted to test the bird and find out what the problem was, understandably so. But again, Tyson Foods owns the birds the entire time. A chicken farmer never owns the most important asset on their farm, which is the bird. So if Doug Elmore had taken one of these chickens and sent it to the University of Arkansas, for example, to be independently tested for disease, Tyson Foods could have sued him for theft of one of its birds. So he had to surrender a diseased bird to a Tyson field technician who took it back to the company to test. And I guess not surprisingly, the test results were delivered back to him that said it was essentially his fault, that he hadn't been keeping his chicken houses clean enough and that the birds were suffering from ammonia poisoning.
Mm. Well, the chicken market has always been difficult. You write about its history defined by busts and booms pretty much until the 1960s, what you call the beginning of the chickenization of the American diet. Now, how can one company manage to make chicken the nation's most consumed meat? How can that be possible?
It's a pretty remarkable story. Back in the 60s, you know, at that time, it's kind of hard to think of now, but fast food restaurants did not really have much chicken on the menu. This was back before the chicken nugget, back before the chicken tender, back when the idea of eating a chicken sandwich, a chicken patty between two pieces of bread, was kind of an odd thing. Big chains served hamburger. But there was a brilliant entrepreneur in the South, Don Tyson, who realized that through this new system of producing chickens in a factory environment, an industrial system, he could make meat that was far cheaper than beef or pork. And he realized that the cheapness of this meat would make it all but irresistible to fast food chains like McDonald's and Burger King. Don Tyson worked for over a decade to convince McDonald's to put chicken on the menu. He was working their sales team relentlessly. Eventually, really through its own devices, you know, McDonald's decided, yeah, we can't ignore this. And Tyson Foods was one of the first companies to produce the McNugget. And it was so cheap and could be sort of pressed into so many different products, as I said, from like tenders to McNuggets, that soon it became America's most popular meat.
We're talking about the meat racket. That's the title of a new book by Christopher Leonard, and it's a thoroughly and thoughtfully investigated book and report about how our nation's meat production has been taken over by four major companies relatively quickly. Christopher, NPR's Dan Charles recently reported on this contract farming model, which is part of the vertical integration model that you talk about, initiated by Tyson Foods, now followed by just about everybody. Now, here he is in one of his reports introducing Tom Vukina. He's an economist at North Carolina State University. He studied the model and says from an economic point of view, it's brilliant. So here's Dan Charles and then Tom Vukina.
Vukina says contract farming solves problems like how do you make sure workers do a good job even when you can't watch what they do? How do you convince independent contractors to invest in new and better equipment? These are problems that economists have tried to solve with complex theories.
This thing has phenomenal, theoretically correct design features that they actually came up with knowing absolutely nothing about contract theory. It's actually remarkable. I think it's totally mind-boggling.
So there we have an economist praising this contract farming model, the result of which has created efficient production and pretty much cheap meat to Americans for decades, which he argues benefits society as a whole. So what, to your mind, doesn't work about this contract farming model?
Well, I'd like to address two points there, and I'll save one for later, which is the cheapness of chicken. But first of all, I interviewed the people that built this system initially. At Tyson Foods, for example, a gentleman named Joe Fred Starr, who was a close advisor of Don Tyson, another man named Jim Blair, who was senior attorney, general counsel at Tyson Foods, worked with Don Tyson for decades. And I think that economist does have something right in that this system was designed to control the farmer in a way that's difficult to do. I mean, Joe Fred Starr told me that back in the 60s, Tyson Foods realized you couldn't really hire somebody to do this job. It's a 7-day-a-week job. It's very tough. You have to be on point around the clock in case something goes wrong in the chicken houses. And these companies realized that if an independent farmer was heavily indebted, they had that motivation to stay on the farm 7 days a week and work on it. And the company made a strategic choice back in the 60s that they were not going to own these farms. Tyson initially experimented with owning the farms, realized it was kind of a crummy investment, and they'd rather leave that on the balance sheet of rural America, and found a group of farmers who were willing to enter contracts like this because, frankly, jobs in agriculture are fewer and more far between today than they were in the past when this company got started. But I really want to address this notion that the industry delivers these wonderful efficiencies to consumers. It's really, in the past, was true. When you look at the inflation-adjusted cost of meat over decades, you see something really interesting. The inflation-adjusted cost of meat fell steadily through the 70s and 80s as we industrialized the system. But, you know, in economics, everything has a cost. And the cost of this upfront savings for meat was that we traded away our competitive meat industry. And in the late 90s, you saw something really interesting start to happen. That cost curve flattened out. And then it started to rise. Today, meat prices are rising sharply. And that's not news to anybody who shops at the grocery store or anybody trying to feed a family on a budget. Meat prices are climbing very sharply. And that is due, in part, to the fact that we've lost competition in this business. History tells us time and again that when you let too few companies gain too much control over a market, they exercise that market power. It's pretty basic. And that's exactly what the meat companies are doing today, and they're keeping prices higher for consumers than prices otherwise would be.
I know for myself, my grocery bill has pretty much doubled since 2008, and I'm not feeding a big family. Is it really up to the consumer to change this system by rejecting these big-name foods?
It is totally unreasonable to expect that your average family is going to be able to buy all of their meat from the local farmers market. That's just not a realistic option for people. We've seen this happen repeatedly in the United States, that industries will become very consolidated. It happened 100 years ago. There's a wonderful book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called The Bully Pulpit that records an era like this in history 100 years ago. You know, industries will become highly consolidated. Monopolistic abuses will become widespread. And really what needs to happen is a public policy approach that will help reintroduce competition. I mean, competition is really at the root of capitalism. Transparent markets, open markets, competition that can allow new entrepreneurs to enter the field. That's the lifeblood of capitalism and free markets. That's what makes things work really well. And to do that, sometimes you need an outside hand to steer a market that has been taken over by just a few entities.
Christopher Leonard, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the time.
Christopher Leonard is former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press and currently fellow with the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And we do have much more on the book, including Tyson's written statement responding to Christopher Leonard's book, and also our full interview with Doris Kearns Goodwin about the bully pulpit, which Christopher mentioned today. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for a conversation with a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on the science behind the $1 trillion processed food industry. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Like it or not, you know the slogan.
You have some more.
Once you pop, you can stop. Once you pop, hey, you can stop.
Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Michael Moss confirms it. Once you pop that Pringles can, you really can't stop. In his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, he dives into the $1 trillion processed food industry and the science and business behind manufacturing mouth-watering, craveable foods. The book is now out on paperback. Michael Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you use the phrase bliss point throughout the book. What is the bliss point?
So you have to love the language that this processed food industry uses when they think they're just talking to each other about their efforts to maximize the allure of their products. Salt, they call the flavor burst. Fat, the mouthfeel. Bliss point is the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much, that describes their efforts to send us over the moon, their products flying off the shelf. I was actually lucky to spend time with the guy who invented the term.
Wow.
A legend in the industry, Howard Moskowitz.
So the bliss point is not just about satisfying a craving and a taste in itself, but actually manufacturing a craving. Tell us more about that.
Well, or engineering in his term. He is trained in experimental psychology from Harvard, responsible for many of the icons in the grocery store. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, in which, and it's an engineering process as he describes it. He started with no less than 59 different formulations of sweetness, each one just slightly different than the others, subjected that to 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country, took the data, threw it in his computer, did his high math regression analysis thing, and out comes these charts of bell-shaped curves like kids get graded on at school, except that the top of the curve is not the dreaded middle C, but the bliss point, the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much.
For the book, you visited Moskowitz and the Monell Chemical Senses Center. So tell us what that is.
Well, Monell is a center that receives funding both from the government and from the food industry, but its researchers are incredibly independent-minded. They are looking at the basic tastes and our growing dependence, in fact, on processed foods. It was Monell where I learned that we're not even born liking salt. That doesn't develop until about 6 months of age. And they did a recent study showing that kids who are exposed to grocery food, which is inherently typically very salty, are much more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in pre-K than kids who are fed, you know, whole, natural, fresh vegetables and fruits. So what that tells us is that the industry is not just responding to our genetic liking for salt in this case, but actually causing us, affecting us to develop cravings for us.
I wouldn't imagine the food industry welcoming investigation of how food flavors are engineered to suck people in. How did you gain access to this facility, the Monell Chemical Senses Center, were scientists open to talking to you about their research?
Well, the book is filled with inside documents. I was lucky to come across a trove of them, some 8 million pages that put me at the table of the largest food companies in the country as they're formulating and marketing their products. And it was those documents that enabled me to identify key players in the industry, convince them to talk to me. They opened up and told even more secrets, because one of the surprising things, many of them have come to have substantial regret about their life work. So these are on the record interviews of bench chemists and marketing officials and CEOs, basically explaining to me how they did it.
Did they talk with you about calculating this bliss point and this mouthfeel and this flavor burst?
No, absolutely, for product after product that I sort of go through in the book. I mean, look, they will argue that they are coming somewhat short of actually encouraging us to overeat, right? Over-consume. And I totally buy into it. I don't see this as this evil industry that intentionally set out to make us overweight or otherwise ill. They are companies doing what companies do, which is to try to make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible and maximizing the allure of their product. But I have to say, looking at the documents and the interviews, the overwhelming sense you get is that this is an industry that's driving day and night to get us not just to like their products, but to want more and more of them. And that's, of course, where the problem lies. It's not salt, sugar, fat. It's the huge amounts in processed foods and our growing reliance on processed foods.
Michael Moss is with us. We're talking with him about the paperback release of his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Why did these scientists and food engineers feel regret, do you think? I mean, they may not have set out to hook people, but have they seen how far it's gone and feel culpable?
I open the book with this meeting in 1999 of the CEOs of the largest food companies in North America. It's a very private meeting. They rarely get together, but they have been called together. It's the old Pillsbury headquarters in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to discuss none other than the emerging obesity epidemic. And they've been asked to come and talk about it by none other than people within their own companies, cabals of insiders who had becoming increasingly concerned about their culpability in obesity. And up before them stands one of their own, a senior official from Kraft. He's armed with 114 slides, and he lays at their feet not just culpability for obesity, but diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. He even links highly processed foods to several types of cancers, and he pleads with them to collectively start doing something on behalf of consumers to make their products healthier.
Well, so Kraft undertakes this anti-obesity initiative beginning in 2003, a couple of years after that meeting. How has that worked out for them?
Well, here's the problem. And first of all, Kraft does three incredibly amazing things. It decides it's being over-aggressive in marketing its least healthy products to children. It cuts back on that. It decides it's being less than honest with consumers in disclosing calorie loads in snack packages with more than a couple of servings, because their own data showed that many of us will eat the entire package, and if they didn't see the total calorie count, would get not a full sense of how much they're eating. And they also put limits on the amount of salt, sugar, fat that their chemists could add to the products. What happened was that Kraft, because they weren't able to convince the whole industry to join them in this anti-obesity initiative, was acting unilaterally, and they immediately ran into trouble in the cookie aisle, where other companies came in with fatter, richer, bigger cookies, and Kraft felt it had to respond. That's when we started seeing the double stuff Oreo and the triple stuff Oreo and variations on and on and on.
They describe it not only pinpointing the amount of salt and fat and sugar needed to hit this bliss point, not too much, not too little, but also the feeling that those ingredients produce. Like what?
Well, if you ask me, I'm actually more of a salt, fat sort of guy. It's potato chips for me. I mean, look, and in fact, they have all three. Potato chips, if we know, have a good amount of salt. The industry describes that as the flavor burst. They have the fat, right, which is not one of the five basic tastes. It's a feeling that gets picked up by the trigeminal nerve. But just like salt goes right to the reward center of the brain, which sends out those signals of pleasure that encourages to do more. But something I didn't know is that potato chips are also loaded with sugar in the form of the simple potato starch, which gets converted to glucose the second it hits the tongue.
It's all making sense now.
Right, it does. I got cravings talking to these food scientists and listening to their incredibly skillful efforts to maximize the allure.
And as I hear this, you know, scientists fiddling around to make food more craveable, kids high on sugar, big money going into marketing. Sounds very familiar. The tobacco industry comes to mind. Do you see a parallel?
Well, there was a parallel. Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company, became the largest food manufacturer starting in the 80s when it bought General Foods and then Kraft. First couple decades of ownership, you see the tobacco managers through the documents doing what you would expect of them. They're nudging, cajoling their food managers to sell more product, even lending them some of their marketing schemes. But in the late 90s, something really surprising happens. Philip Morris gets religion on government intervention. It becomes the first company to embrace government regulation of tobacco. And when they do that, the tobacco managers turn to their food managers and warn them that they're going to have as great or greater problem with salt, sugar, fat, obesity, as Philip Morris was having with nicotine and tobacco. Mm-hmm. And they urge the food managers to start reducing their, lowering their dependence on those three ingredients.
Well, the tobacco industry did come under heavy fire for misleading smokers about the dangers and addictive nature of cigarettes. We all know it's bad. Smoking has dropped dramatically in the past 20 years. Could the same thing happen for processed food?
I think we're at a real tipping point. More and more people are caring about what they're putting into their bodies. They're starting to translate that into purchase decisions. If nothing else, the processed food industry is acutely sensitive to sales drops, and they will respond. They will make truly healthier versions of their products if forced to do it by declining sales.
Michael Moss, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Moss, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, reporter for The New York Times, and author to the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. There's much more on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. From food scientists manipulating flavors to promote cravings to mega-dollar marketing campaigns, the food industry goes to great lengths to raise profits. What if your bottom line was not about dollars, but devotion? Roman Mars of the 99% Invisible podcast brings us this story of a group of Trappist monks who brew the highest-rated beer in the world, all, in their view, for the glory of God.
Cyrus Farivar is on a mission. He's trying to get a case of beer called Westvleteren.
Westvleteren. I'm not Dutch, so I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's Westvleteren.
It's not easy to get, but apparently it's worth it.
Oh, yes.
If you're a beer nerd or have a friend who's a beer nerd, you've probably heard of Belgian beers. Belgians take their beer very seriously. There are about 200 breweries in a country about twice the size of the Bay Area.
Now, amongst these Belgian breweries and Belgian ales, there's a very specific subtype. Trappist beers. Here's what you need to know about Trappist beers. First, they're amazing. Second, they're made by Trappist monks. These monks trace their roots to a monastery in 17th century France and have since spread out to all over the world.
The main concept behind the Trappist lifestyle is that the abbey should be economically self-sufficient. In other words, the monks should make something and sell it to the public as a way to fund the operations of the abbey itself. Some make cheese, some make spirits. There's even one in Germany that makes lentil soup.
But none of the Trappist products are nearly anywhere as famous as the beer.
But here's the thing about Westvleteren. You can't go there and have as much beer as you want. You can't even have it shipped from the abbey.
If you want to buy beer to take with you, you have to look up the beer reservation phone number on the abbey's website. Then you call this certain phone number during certain hours on certain days. If you're lucky enough to talk to a monk, and yes, you do talk to a monk, to take your reservation, you have to give your license plate number and be available to come pick up your crate during the appointed time that weekend. You're limited to one crate per person, per car, maximum two per car. And you can't buy more than one crate during a 60-day period. Oh, and you agree not to resell the beer as well.
For information, please see our website.
You got that. There is a list of several seemingly arbitrary hoops that you have to jump through if you want to buy this beer. This sort of thing is not unheard of. Velvet ropes and random reward have long been imposed to create artificial scarcity and to heighten demand. But the mainstream trend today seems to be more geared towards greater access and accommodation for customers. The new ideal is that everything is available at all times, no matter where you live. This is the digital age, but clearly, this is not the case for the Westvleteren Trappists. They're trying to make it as difficult as possible.
No. They don't make it difficult. You make it difficult. too much people want this beer.
This is Jeff Vondenstein. He's the author of a book called Trappist, The Seven Heavenly Beers. And he's even a brewer himself.
Until 10 years ago, you could go to the Abbey, except on Sunday, because then they don't work. And except on Friday, they don't work, because they don't eat. But Saturday, they were open, so you went there, and without problems, you could buy beer. Not as much as you want, 3 crates or 2 crates. But then the Americans, it's all your fault.
I'm sorry.
The Americans said Westvleteren is the best beer of the world. They decided we brew the same amount as the last 40, 50 years. And they have enough of that. So why must they brew more? Because you won't. No. They live between the walls of the Abbey, so for them it's not a problem.
Clearly the Westvleteren Trappists take pride in creating something great that people enjoy. But you, the consumers of beer, are not the real customer. God is.
The head of the Abbey says on their website, "We are not brewers. We are monks. We brew beer to be able to afford being monks."
And in that sense, their sometimes frustrating customer service is designed perfectly for the customer they care about most. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Sarus Farivar and me, Roman Mars. It's a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco. We're distributed by PRX at prx.org.
After the break, word of mouth continues, considering how we eat, with a look at the sticky business of making maple syrup. From black market sales to stolen syrup, we're going to test the quaint image of New England's sweetest export. Stay with us for that when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
First, you get the buckets ready, clean the pans, and gather firewood late in the winter. It's maple syrup time.
After years of record high temperatures, sugar houses across New England are waiting out this winter's deep freeze and crossing their fingers that it will make for plenty of sap. Sugaring is one of the nation's oldest agricultural crafts and is now a multi-billion dollar business, shadowed by cutthroat competition, sap heists, charges of tree doping to increase yield, and a federation that influences the international market. That's what operations like Bascom Farms in Acworth, New Hampshire are up against. Bascom is one of the largest producers of pure maple syrup in New England, making up to 80,000 gallons of sap a day, a mind-boggling number that got the attention of the writer Douglas Wynot. He decided to follow the Bascom family to get a better understanding of the maple syrup industry, and his new book is called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. Douglas Wynot, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So I learned a lot in this book, plenty, one of which was that the maple syrup industry peaked around the time of the Civil War. Now, why was that?
Well, at that time, a lot of people were making maple sugar. It was a dry sugar that they used as a staple. And also, there was a political movement in this country that was called No Sugar Made by Slaves. It was an abolitionist feeling, especially in Vermont, I've read. And going back in history, Thomas Jefferson spearheaded a movement of self-sufficiency in this country to produce maple sugar in order to compete against the sugar industry in the Caribbean. It was the peak of the maple sugar industry, and it went steadily down from the 1860s until the 1960s when Bruce Bascom began to produce maple syrup and use plastic tubing instead of buckets.
Bascom's family made a transition from dairy farming mm-hmm. into the maple business and has since grown this huge empire. Mm-hmm. Give us a little sense about how that evolved.
Well, when Bruce was a boy in the 50s and 60s, he worked alongside his dad, tapping trees, putting in spouts, hanging a bucket on the spout. The sap would go drip, 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 and they would empty a bucket every couple of days, a couple of gallons. And Ken Bascom decided that he would sell his dairy herd that his father had begun and that he had developed to 80 animals. And it was a big risk. It was a big leap for him to do that during that time. No one where he lived in that part of New Hampshire had ever gone into the endeavor of making maple syrup full time. Well, this happened when Bruce was a teenager. He was about 13, 14 years old. And Bruce decided then that someday he would try to make a living making maple syrup. So he went to UNH. His father and his uncles had all gone to the ag school, but Bruce went to the business school. Mm-hmm. And for his senior project in an entrepreneurial marketing course, management course, he designed a project in which there would be 25,000 taps on plastic tubing all feeding into a central sugar house. And that was kind of a revolutionary idea. And at the time, people didn't believe that that would be possible. Bruce's classmates kind of made fun of him, called it the flubbing tubing product. He went to the bank the next year. The bankers refused to lend him money to do this. But his father talked to the bankers, and he went back, and he got the money for the tubing. And Bruce, along with Peter Rhodes and a cousin, eventually set up the largest tubing system in New England and became the largest producers of maple syrup in New England within about a decade. And Bruce is a real energetic go-getter type of guy. So he just started adding on and adding on and adding on. As a matter of fact, his first year back from college, he went around knocking on doors and asking if he could rent trees from his neighbors. He rented one tree, you know, many, many trees at 10 cents per tap and gathered, as a result, gathered so much syrup that he overwhelmed his dad. That was kind of the beginning of what became the biggest producer in New England and remains the biggest producer in New Hampshire. Bascom Maple Farms makes about one quarter of all the maple syrup in New Hampshire.
And how does it stack up in competition with the fake maple syrup, you know, the Mrs. Butterworths and Aunt Jemimas that we see in supermarkets and on tables all over the place?
Yeah, well, that's their problem. I mean, they're always up against the artificials. That is an $18 billion industry with syrups made from high fructose corn syrup and artificial caramel color and then a flavor derived from the fenugreek plant. I asked Bruce recently what the average consumption of maple syrup was in this country, and he said per person it's about 3 ounces.
Wow. I guess he wants to get that number up.
I guess he does.
Now, wait, you mentioned an $18 billion market. How much is the pure maple syrup market?
I heard it's $800
million. Oh, wow. So just a fraction.
Yeah. So it's under a billion, and you know that was the number that Bruce gave me. So it's very small.
We're getting schooled in maple syrup with Douglas Wynot. He's got a new book out called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. For his research, he followed Bascom Farms in Ackworth, New Hampshire, in their operations day in and day out for a couple of years to get a sense of the industry, which is a multi-million dollar industry, and it also has its kind of shadowy side. Last year, we reported on a maple syrup heist in a town just north of Montreal. 6 million pounds of maple syrup worth about $18 million wholesale, stolen from a warehouse. Doug, what does this reveal about the underbelly, the black market operating in the maple syrup industry?
Well, that was all based in Quebec, where there is a huge maple syrup industry. And most of the commercial producers, or all of the commercial producers in Quebec, are members of an organization called the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers. It has a French name. The federation controls the bulk sales of maple syrup. And they also, starting in 2002, started what they call the Global Strategic Reserve of Maple Syrup, most commonly called the surplus. And they began to set aside a certain amount of syrup to provide supply in case there was a shortage. Because
so like federal strategic oil reserves or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly wow. like that. It's the same thing. So after they started the surplus, there were a few years where there were big crops and they had in their supply a whole year's worth of crop. And so as a result, the Federation established quotas and there were some serious conflicts as a result of that and there were threats and the president's sugar house was burned down. But it proved to be right because between the years of 2006, 2007, 2008, there were some winters that were extended winters where it was very, very cold and then it suddenly turned to spring and the crops were way down. And as a result, there was a supply available from the Federation to sell to the supermarkets and to put on the shelves. So anyway, in 2011 into 2012, a group of people in Quebec went into one of the Federation warehouses and began emptying barrels. They filled some of the barrels with water and left some of them empty. On July 30th, 2012, an auditor went into this warehouse. It was a rented warehouse. The Federation was building a third warehouse for the supply, the surplus. And the auditor went in and discovered that there was water in one of the barrels and there were some empty barrels. So an investigation began, and eventually arrests were made. It was a lot of syrup, 6 million pounds, 8,000 barrels, $20 million worth, so a significant amount. And that syrup kind of gradually bled into the market before the discovery of the theft. So this syrup was just sort of circulating into the market before anyone knew about this. The arrests were made at the end of 2012, I think it was 20, 23 people were charged and arrested, and the trials still are
who was behind him? Were these just like hired guns or what?
Well, it was various people in Quebec who were opposed to the Federation and the control of the Federation and who were trading in black market syrup, say, before the stolen syrup came onto the market. I mean, when I talked to the director of the Federation, I asked her, I said, is there a black market? And she said, well, that's human nature.
Well, you're getting to something that's so interesting that comes across in the book. You know, we have this kind of maple syrup seems like one of the most wholesome things that you can possibly imagine, you know, tapping a tree, running a line into your barn. And it's really such a different thing. Bruce Bascom is tearing his hair out or trying to keep his stride half the time, figuring out how to balance the supply that's down in his cellar with what he's putting out in the market. You spoke to several owners of sugar houses that are so worried about, you know, will they have enough? Will they have too much? Mm-hmm. And this is all dependent on nature.
It is.
In order for these operations to survive in the future, what kind of technologies are they going to have to embrace?
You may remember that in 2012, it got up into the 80s, and for 10 days, temperatures were above freezing. What I discovered and what sugar makers discovered was that during this warm year, when sap was coming out of the trees at times like jelly or cottage cheese was what David Marvin described to me and other sugar makers because it was so hot, they found that they could still gather sap by using vacuum systems. Long after the people using buckets and who are on what is called on gravity, long after they're finished, people on tubing with advanced vacuum systems can keep making syrup. And Bascom's has been able to do that. They were able to produce a decent crop in 2012 when other producers had, you know, a 10% or 20% crop. So,
well, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Really
nice
appreciate
to talk
it. To you. Douglas Wynot's new book is called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. We do have more information on the book. He is also the author of A Unit of Water, A Unit of Time, Giant Bluefin, and he teaches writing at Boston's Emerson College and lives right here in Langdon, New Hampshire. Well, after after the interview, we asked Douglas to stick around for a sticky challenge, a blind maple syrup taste test. The aim was to test his ability to distinguish between the various grades of maple syrup. So we sat down with 5 cups. 3 were filled with varieties of grade A, light, medium, and dark. There was also a cup with grade B syrup, which has a stronger maple flavor and has traditionally been used for cooking. And of course, the Ringer, a brand name artificial syrup. And because you can tell a lot by the color of syrup, both Douglas and I donned blindfolds for the occasion. Well, not blindfolds exactly. Our producers tied one of my scarves around Douglas's head, and I wore an Elmer Fudd hat over my eyes to prevent any accidental or intentional cheating. So I'm starting?
Yep. Yeah, you go first. Did you miss?
I hit the microphone. I'm thinking that's a grade A.
I'm thinking it's close to that. It's somewhere in the middle.
Maybe an amber.
Yeah, it doesn't have that strongish bite, but there's a lot of flavor. Maybe it's an amber.
You know, what are you looking for when you're tasting the syrup?
Sometimes it's the texture of the syrup, but I'm looking for that burst of the maple flavor that comes after it moves into your mouth, kind of spreads out over your tongue, and pops.
This smells much, much stronger.
Not distracted. Oh, it moves so slowly.
Mm-hmm. This feels like the flavor is out in front and the scent is out in front. You know, there's no subtlety there.
Right. Maybe I'll say that's the artificial. Well, when I was a kid, Vermont Made and those other syrups had 2% maple syrup. And it had come down from 15% originally, and then I think it went down to 8 or so, somewhere in that area, and then down to 2. And then one of the brands eliminated maple syrup and went totally artificial and gained in market share.
No kidding.
And that was devastating for the industry at that time. That was in the 60s.
All right, here you go. This is a really nice one. It's very, it feels darker to me. It feels like it has
yes.
a sort of heavier bottom.
Yes, it has a heavier bottom. That's a real strong maple flavor. To me, that's the best.
One of those back-of-mouth flavors, too.
And vanillin is one of the most dominant flavor precursor in maple syrup. And so I would say there's definitely a presence of the vanillin taste in that syrup.
Maybe it's grade B?
That's what I wrote,
that's
grade
what
B.
Thinking.
Some people used to say that grade B was for cooking, but I talked to a syrup producer who has an account in Cambridge at a restaurant, and he said that when the waitresses served grade B syrup, they got higher tips.
No kidding.
And he would bring lighter syrup to them. They would complain.
Oh, that's got a nice flavor. It's thinner.
There's something else in this.
I don't taste as much of the vanillin that you mentioned.
No, there's something else. It's so hard to come up with adjectives for the actual flavors, but this has something
it's
more...
It's warmer.
Warmer,
it's...
yeah. Orangey almost.
That's also delicious.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That moves differently, too.
It does.
Across your mouth.
What is that? What is that quality? Is that just how much they boil it?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, they boil it to come to 66 or 67%. Maybe it moved a little bit beyond that, 68 or something. We're feeling that as it moves. But this is it feels lighter, but the flavor is sort of a centrality to the maple flavor. I'm going to try that again.
That was Douglas Wynot, professor of writing at Emerson College and author of a new book about the maple syrup industry and a family who makes it. After we tasted all 5 of the maple syrup varieties, we took off our blindfolds and checked to see how accurate we were. Of course, there was only 1 cup we really wanted to be able to tell from the rest.
All right, this is our moment of truth.
This is the...
Fake number 2.
As long as we got the fake.
That's the important thing.
Here's to us.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks to Douglas for being such a good sport. You can watch a video of our somewhat comical blind taste test at wordofmouthradio.org. You'll also find details to hear Douglas talk about his book. He'll be at Gibson's Bookstore on Tuesday, April 2nd. There's more on the event, the book, the sugar season, and a link to watch that video at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending a little bit of your weekend with Word of Mouth. If you do like what you heard, there's much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more on Monday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.